this morning, I'm going to take up the sacrifice of Isaac. And I shall deal, first of all, with Luther's treatment of the theme. But a word of preface is needed in advance, because Luther interprets it in terms of typology. Now, typology was one of the devices for both linking and separating the Old Testament from the New. Christianity was a new religion, but it came out of Judaism. Should it sever itself completely from Judaism? There was an early Christian named Martian who thought so. He said the God of the Old Testament was brutal. He commanded the slaughter of the Canaanites. That could not be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. He was rather a demon. And therefore the Old Testament should be rejected. The church felt that that would be an immense loss. But how were they to explain the fact that they rejected the Jewish law and yet retained the books of the Old Testament which enjoined the Jewish law? How in general were they to explain both the continuity and the discontinuity? One device was prophecy. They saw in the Old Testament various predictions of what was to come. There shall be a prince of peace. There shall be a redeemer riding upon an ass, lowly. There is a suffering servant. There is the prediction that in the new age your sons and your daughters will prophesy, and so on. Sayings were treated as predictions, such as, "It's as I have called my son out of Egypt." This must be a reference to the flight of the Holy Family into Egypt, and so on. But the other device was typology. That is to say that various events and figures in the Old Testament were types of Christ. The water which destroyed the host of Pharaoh was baptism. The Ark of Noah was the Ark of the Church. The brazen serpent lifted up in the wilderness was the type of Christ. And so on in many other instances. Well, now, this might serve the purpose of continuity, but also of discontinuity. Because you might say, this was a type, a foreshadowing, but now that which is perfect has come, you're through with the type and the foreshadowing. It had an effect on New England's political history, by the way, because the early settlers believed that they were reviving the old Israel of God. This was to be the new Israel of God. It was to have a theocratic constitution like that of ancient Israel. But Roger Williams used typology in reverse, and he said all of the kingship of ancient Israel was a type, but as soon as the true King of Kings came, that was all done with. So we're not to have a religious oligarchy. We're not to have a union of church and state. All of this typology is done with. Well, you have something like it in Paul with regard to the law. It was a schoolmaster to lead us to Christ, and now that we have come to Christ, we can dismiss the schoolmaster. So you've got this problem of continuity and discontinuity. History is something like a symphony with recurring themes all mounting to a great climax, and that is Christ. And these themes are recurrent in the Old Testament, and this is continuity. And the other is, you've got to get some way of showing why it is that you don't do everything in the Old Testament. This applied not only to the kingship, but it applied to the suicide of Samson, the stealing from the Egyptians, the polygamy of the patriarchs, and various other practices in the Old Testament which were deemed non-Christian. Now, sometimes they got out of that by saying that that was due to special circumstance. They had polygamy in order to get the earth populated. It was pretty slim at that time. But now we got enough, and so we can quit, and one will be enough. But the other way to say was, God commanded it, and anything he commands is all right, because God is a law unto himself. Well, that sort of demoralizes God. It de-Christianizes God, that he commanded the invasion of Canaan and the slaughter of the Canaanites, and so on. And the same thing applies to the sacrifice of Isaac. God commanded it. But we don't sacrifice. We don't sacrifice today. And here, typology becomes discontinuous because Christ is the final sacrifice, and therefore we don't need any more sacrifices like this anymore. And yet it was a foreshadowing of the sacrifice of Christ. Now that's about the way in which Luther looks at it. I shall now give you the story about as Luther gives it in his commentary on Genesis. And God told Abraham that he must sacrifice Isaac. Abraham turned pale. It was not only that he would lose his beloved son, the son of his old age, by a miracle, but God would be a liar. For God has said, through Isaac thou shalt have seed, and thou shalt be the father of many peoples and of a great nation. And now God says, kill Isaac. Who would not hate a God so contradictory? And why couldn't he talk it over with somebody? He knew that if he disclosed what God had said to him, he would be dissuaded. Why couldn't he talk it over with Sarah? He had to fight it out alone. And Abraham rose early in the morning. He was to go to Mount Moriah. It was some distance away. He saddled an ass. He did it himself. And he cleaved the wood. He split the very wood. And he was thinking to himself every minute, this is going to burn Isaac. This will burn Isaac. And he was so beside himself that he scarcely knew what he was doing. And then he took two servants and the ass, and he bound the wood to the ass, and with Isaac and the servants he went for 3 days toward Mount Moriah. And all that time he was thinking. He couldn't see the end. That's just the way it is with us when we're depressed. We don't see to the end. If we knew how it would come out, we wouldn't be depressed. That's just the nature of our tribulations. We can't see through to the end. He couldn't see through to the end. And after the 3 days, when Mount Moriah was in sight, he dismissed the servants and the ass, and he took the wood and he gave it to Isaac. And he took the sacrificial knife, and they walked together. Who? The Father, knowing that he must come back alone. And the boy, obedient and trustful. And the boy was solicitous. He said, Father, he called him Father, you got the knife and I've got the wood, but where's the lamb? And Abraham said, my boy, God will provide a lamb. And when they came to Mount Moriah, he built an altar, and then he had to tell him. And here, Luther imagines the conversation. Isaac must have said to him, but Father, how can it be? Didn't God give me to you when mother was so old? Didn't he tell you you were going to be the father of a great nation, and that through me your descendants would be as the sands. And Abraham said, my boy, God can create a great nation out of ashes. And Isaac didn't say another word. And Abraham bound him and laid him on the altar. And there was not another word. And Abraham raised his knife. The boy did not wince. Was there ever such obedience in all history save in Christ? If God had not been watching, it would have been over in a minute. I can hardly bear myself to imagine it. The knife was raised. It was about to strike. And the angel said, Abraham. Abraham, and the ram was in the thicket. Even so, in life we say we die, but in death God says to us, nay, you live. Now Luther told this story for morning devotions, and when he finished, Katie said, I don't believe it. God wouldn't do that to his son. And Luther answered, but Katie, he did. This is typology, you see. It's not exact, because actually Isaac was saved and Christ was not saved. But it's the idea of the theme of sacrifice running all the way through. And there's also the point that God doesn't always cry, Abraham, Abraham, but he lets the knife come down. Now that's Luther's version of it. My son-in-law has just written an essay on this, on the interpretation of this theme from various points of view. I've read it in advance and found it very illuminating. He shows how the rabbis interpreted it. Now, they couldn't see it culminating in Christ, in the Midrash and so on. And some of them say God didn't command it. Well, if God didn't command it, Abraham must have been under some kind of an illusion. Then you turn to the modern anthropologist, and he does not interpret it as a divine command. He's like the rabbis, and he's like Katie, but not for the same reason. He inquires, why would Abraham have to sacrifice his son, supposing that God didn't tell him so? Because Abraham must have been the leader of the religious community who was called upon to make an annual sacrifice for the sake of the people, as in Mexico, for example. The lot has fallen on his own son. If he doesn't go through with it, disasters will overtake the people during the course of the coming year. He will be faithless to his own people. He will be faithless to his duty if, despite his own personal feeling, he does not carry through this act which is necessary to appease the God. Therefore, Abraham must do it. Well, now that creates for Abraham a double trial. If he comes back without Isaac, he faces Sarah. If he comes back with Isaac, he faces the tribe. And they'll probably kill Isaac and him too for not carrying out his duty. Possibly you can combine these in some measure, namely, that there's a double problem. Either way, he's caught. It's Sarah in the one case, it's the tribe in the other. How frightful a decision, then, you have on the part of Abraham. But the anthropologist might say that the real miracle in this whole story is that Abraham persuaded his people that God didn't want it. And that this story really marks, in the form of an historical incident, an entire transition in the history of Israel, namely the giving up of human sacrifice, which continued among many other Semitic peoples of the period, way down into the time of Christ. The Phoenicians were sacrificing to Moloch, the fires of Moloch. So here then is an amazing transition which marks the superiority of the Jewish people to all of their neighbors, in that they came to have a new concept of God. And it's entirely conceivable that an individual brought it about. Individuals are important in history. There are great movements that seem to come up spontaneously, but they're commonly sparked by somebody who voices it, frames it, dramatizes it, and brings it to a head. It was much the same with Luther in the Reformation. Others had said much that he had said, but it all came to a focus. So that individuals often have a very crucial role to play in history. And it may well be that Abraham was a Luther to his generation, or Luther an Abraham to his generation. And then there's another point here which my son-in-law stresses in this article, namely timing. Luther says, if God had not been watching, it would have been over in a second. Timing. Just in time. And so it was that Luther responded to a particular time, a particular crisis. It didn't look as if it would become anything in particular, but he was simply outraged because his parishioners were getting indulgences, bargaining with God, thinking they get the slate clean by making a contribution, treating God as if they could make a deal with him. And Luther spoke up. And it was at a crucial moment, because he'd said much the same thing a year before, and it hadn't done anything. This time it hit at a particular moment. Of course, he didn't know that it was going to be a particular moment, but nevertheless, it was a moment on which he laid hold. So that's one point which I think is worth thinking of in connection with this story. If God hadn't been watching, it would have been over like that. Timing. This also illustrates the richness of biblical material. Gregory the Great said, the Bible is like a stream, so shallow that in it a lamb can wade, and so deep that in it an elephant can swim. Every incident has so many undertones and overtones, such richnesses of meaning, that one can lay hold here, lay hold there, and find a new insight every time one comes to it. And that again is what amazes me about Luther in his treatment of the Bible. Following the Christian year, he had to deal with Advent and Christmas and Easter every year for some 40 years. But every time he comes back to it, he finds something there he didn't see the last time. There's some new nuance, some new little bit of it that he catches hold of this time, and it all comes again to life. Well, now, I'm going to throw the matter open for whatever sort of comments you are inclined to make. that if we have a Quaker meeting, that is not a calamity. Yes?
I couldn't help but thinking about Kierkegaard.
Yes.
Very troubling. I just covet your response to Kierkegaard's treatment.
Yes, yes, I'm not hearing too well. Tell me what he says.
The Kierkegaard is very troubling. They,
yes, yes, the
rising, up, rising above the suspension of the ethical.
Yes, yes.
And to the religious dimension above the ethical. It wasn't ethical to kill your son, but God comes before that.
Well, I'm inclined at that point to say with Erasmus, let God be good, rather than to say that the will of God transcends the Christian morality. Now that troubled Luther greatly on the score of predestination, because Erasmus said to him, if God has chosen some before they're born to be saved and others to be damned, he's a tyrant. And Erasmus said, who are you to pass God's judgment on God? Let God be God. Some things can be understood by the light of nature, some by the light of grace, and some only by the light of glory. And we will not get this one straightened out to the light of glory. Luther didn't say that God was immoral, that he was a tyrant. He said, we don't see how he can't, how he isn't. But we'll have to take it. Then, of course, Erasmus came back at him, but how do you know that he did do this? He said, well, out of the Bible. And then Luther quoted to him the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. And Erasmus replies, oh, God didn't harden his heart. He just gave him a chance to show how hard it was. And then Erasmus says, well, Esau have I loved. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated before they were born. Erasmus says, well, that's because he saw how they'd turn out. Well, this was the usual interpretation down to St. Augustine, and Luther followed Augustine, and Erasmus followed the earlier fathers. But the main point I'm making is that Erasmus was not willing to make God so absolute that all morality, Christian morality, loses its religious foundation. And that discussion went back of Luther to the late scholastics, who were saying God is omnipotent, he can do absolutely anything. And then they said, well, could he make right wrong? Could he make black white? Could he make the past not to have been the past so that a harlot would be a virgin? Could he do something preposterous, such as becoming incarnate, not in the man Christ Jesus, but in a donkey or a pumpkin? And Erasmus' reply was, let God be good. That omnipotence must impose upon itself certain limitations to power, because power could corrupt even God. God must impose certain limitations upon himself if he's to be the Christian God, and if Christian morality is to have God's undergirding. So I wouldn't go with Kierkegaard to say that religion can supersede morals. It'll wreck Christian morality if you assume that. Now, I'll agree to all the ambiguity of morals. Indeed, yes. The difficulty of making decisions in concrete situations, certainly. But not that everything depends upon the caprice of God, rather than that God himself has some fundamental grounding in the kind of ethic that we get in the New Testament. I believe in the self-limitation of God. Of course, that's my own view. But speak up, sister, for the Lord. Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth.
That's a liberated man. follow gate at all after he, after he broke with the...
Certainly he did. He used it for his private devotions. De profundis clamavi ad te dominum. Non moriars et vivam. It was, his Bible was the Vulgate. He didn't use his own translation. And that's an interesting thing. He translated the fresh every time he preached. And a colleague of mine, Hans Blum, made up a Luther Bible, which he said was Luther, better than Luther's Bible, and he made it out of Luther. He got his graduate students to go through the whole Weimar edition and write out every translation that Luther made in the course of his commentaries and his sermons. And he got a great case just full of these. He may have 17 translations of one verse that Luther made along the line. And he thinks he could have picked out of all of that better translations of Luther than the one that finally got authorized as Luther's version. Here's one example, and I'd have to look up the Luther Bible to see how it is there. But my friend Blum pointed out what Luther did to the translation of "With desire have I desired to eat with you this Passover." Now that's just plain Hebrew, that desire. It comes over into the Greek, epithymia, epithymesa. It comes over into the Latin, desiderio, desideravi. It comes into the old German, mit begehr, habe ich begehrt. But Luther translated, wie herzlich habe ich begehrt, mit euch das Passalam zu essen. How from the depths of my heart have I longed to eat with you this Passover. Now, I'm not sure whether that's in the official... Have you got Luther's official Bible here? We'll have to check and see whether it's that or whether this one is in one of the other translations that he found. Now, Luther was Luther wasn't bound to his own translation. He was liberated from himself. And he still used the Vulgate for his own devotions.
Well, that relieves me, I've been trying to keep track of the Vulgate, and I thought, I've got to be careful that I don't become un-Lutheran.
Luther said, I care not if all my works perish, if only they'll read the Bible. I don't like anybody to be called Lutheran. I am not a Paul, I am not of Apollos, I am not a Peter. He didn't mind being disagreed with, provided he didn't think that the person was also disagreeing with Christ. then he could flare up. Yes?
I would like to hear you struggle with us a little bit about the need for the kind of testing, the depth of testing that Abraham had to go through in order that he might be that father of a great nation.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's kind of the tradition out of which I have always looked at that story.
That he would nevertheless become the father of a great nation.
Without that testing, how could it have been demonstrated that he was the man of that work that could be the father of a great nation?
Well, of course, that's about what you've got in the New Testament picture. It's a little different. Went out from Ur of Chaldees not knowing whither he went. Another decision on the part of Abraham. Well, I don't think that interpretation is destroyed. Either if you take it simply according to the biblical narrative as Luther interprets it, or again, if you take it anthropologically, that he refused to do what the tribe demanded of him. Because in either case, there was a tremendous testing of faith and an enormous struggle and a valiant defiance of tradition. If it was against the entire tribal custom, I don't see that it takes the heart out of that. He becomes, perhaps even more, he becomes the one who has the right to be the father of a great nation if he persuaded his nation that God didn't ask human sacrifice. Don't you think that rather adds to the dimension?
Being that God made the covenant with Abraham, he was kind of stuck with him anyway, wasn't he?
Well, that raises the... I think it's more significant to say, as Luther said, that God made a covenant with himself. He said, I am the Lord thy God. That's a commitment. I'd rather take it that way than to stress the covenant with Noah, the covenant with Abraham. The covenant idea is important, and to attach it to individuals is also important, but let us not restrict God. The big covenant is with himself. And that implies that God is not just an arbitrary and a capricious God. I am the Lord thy God, and I will not let you down.
If you say that God is consistent and not capricious, and cannot contradict what we understand to be Christian morality, in the asking of Abraham to do this, even though he stayed that way, is there not a contradiction even in his asking this kind of an act?
You say that God wasn't inconsistent in asking Abraham to do it.
No, I'm asking if he was not inconsistent.
If he was not inconsistent? I'm sorry, I'm afraid I haven't heard all of this. The question is whether God was or was not consistent?
The question is, was God consistent in asking Abraham to do something which seemingly in the light of Christian morality would not be consistent?
Well, frankly, I don't believe God told him to do it. I don't believe in these direct, immediate communications. I'm a plain heretic with regard to that. I do believe that God lays commands on us, but I don't think he makes them that specific. Of course, I'm interpreting it partly in the light of my own experience. God has never talked to me that way. But that may well be because I haven't been picked out by God for such special communications. I know the Bible assumes that direct specific commands are given from heaven, but I think they come not quite so directly and not as voices from heaven. Now you'll just have to write me off as non-Lutheran, but that's where I am. I think they come. I do believe that there are commands from God, but they come in multiple ways and in less specific ways. And I don't personally, as I say, get any voices. Now, other people claim they have, and I know they've been mighty servants of the Lord, and it may have come to them and not to me. But I'm rather dubious as to whether these are not devices for concretizing the impact of God on man, rather than specific accounts of direct, worded communication.
What do you do with Paul's conversion then?
I follow Paul and not the book of Acts. It's only in Acts that you have the Damascus Road, and there you have it in two versions. In one, the bystanders see something and hear nothing. In the other, they hear and they don't see anything. And Paul says only, when it was God's good grace to reveal his Son in me, and doesn't give any account of anything like the actual externals of the Damascus Road. It happened all right.
Yeah, and that's what made the ultimate difference was the fact that Paul was changed, right?
Now, yes, a professor of mine wrestled with the question as to historicity and the faith. He said he thought the historical scholar should be absolutely unimpeded in investigating the life of Christ and the whole New Testament period. Well, what if as a result he discovered that Jesus never existed? No. Would Christianity come to an end? He said, no, you still have the values, but there would be an irreparable loss. So he didn't write many books because he could never come into the clear of it. The scholar, the historian, must be free to find out whatever's there, even if there's nothing there, and the believer must believe that there's something there. Now, how do you get them together? Well, he wrote a book on the mind of Christ in Paul, and what appealed to him about Paul was that he'd never seen Christ. It was an interpretation without being a direct witness. And Paul never appeals to outward miracles and signs as demonstrations. It's Christ in me, the hope of glory. So I think perhaps I too am a Paulinist in this regard. Not that I would discard the Gospels by any means and the literal words of Jesus. But we too are in Paul's position. We've never seen the Lord directly. It's his total impact. It's the indwelling of Christ in the heart. This becomes an experience, and out of it grows a theology, as it did for Paul. And it's not so dependent on whether or no the devil appeared in person and said, turn these stones into bread and that kind of thing. You don't have that in Paul. One of my professors was a little flippant, perhaps. He was the dean of our school. He used to preach a good deal in the South. He came from the South. He said, what do I believe about the virgin birth? I believe what the Apostle Paul believed. What did he believe? He never mentioned it. I think his point was that it couldn't be an essential of the Christian faith if Paul never mentioned it. And therefore, don't make so much of it. That's basically what he was saying. Yes?
Excuse me for maybe a bit of naivete, but in your opinion, what would it change if, by historical means of finding truth, it was proven that Jesus never existed?
Well, that was just exactly.
Let's presume it's been proven. What would it change? I mean, as prediction.
Well, you'd still have Christianity as an historical movement. I don't think anybody has ever gone to the length of denying that there was Christianity. There was a church. How did it come into being? If there was no person, Jesus, then how did all of this arise? Kautsky said it was a mythology created by a proletariat with a revolutionary intent. But it's an incredible. Well, of course, you see, I'm starting to argue now for his historicity. You're asking me what will happen if we don't have his historicity. I'm pointing out the difficulties of those who deny the historicity. They've still got Christianity to account for. And you may say it arises as an illusion, but in that case, perhaps thank God for illusions. I mean, you may have to say it was an illusion as to a historical fact, and yet it did enshrine values of universal validity. That, I think, could still be said.
But doesn't that answer the question?
No.
Yeah, I'm not interested now so much as, I rather doubt whether it's a possibility to disprove historicity.
I think it's impossible to prove that it didn't happen. It's just utterly unsound. But nevertheless, if supposing that. Yes, you're asking
what's
left.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. You've got the picture, you've got the ideals. The picture itself is profoundly moving. I'd hate to think it didn't happen, but you still got the picture. Once when I was a student in the divinity school, there was a student in the English department who'd been brought up in a secular home, knew nothing about the Bible, used to come over Saturday nights and talk to me. I read him for the first time in his life the story of the crucifixion. He was in tears. Even if it didn't happen, there's the account of it. And that moved him so. It certainly would be a frightful loss if the Word did not become flesh, if this was not actualized in life. But even as a picture, it is moving. But I don't altogether have to figure out how I'd feel about it if it was proved he wasn't so, because I'm so sure it was. I mean, it doesn't become a personal problem because it's on historical ground. But there are other things than that that are a little bit worse in a way. Morton Smith has just come out with a book, which I haven't read yet, but I've read a long review of it. He has discovered, in the writings of Clement of Alexandria, who wrote around 250 A.D., a fragment of which Clement said was in the Gospel of Mark. And this, according to him, represents Jesus as being a magician. And he infers from that the early Christians were put to death as magicians because magic was forbidden by law in the Roman Empire. They were executed as magicians. And early Christianity was a little cult of magic workers. Well, my feeling about that is, first, you've got to prove it is from Clement of Alexandria, but that seems to be pretty plausible. Secondly, that it is a fragment out of the Gospel of Mark. And he says the language in this fragment fits in with the language of Mark, so he thinks it was. Now, it's quite possible that there was a fragment of Mark that was cut out, because there is a case where that is almost indisputable, because in the early manuscripts, Mark's last chapter ends with verse 16 with the words, "And they told no one, for they were afraid." Well, it surely didn't end that way, because just before that they are told, "Do you not recall that he said he would go before you into Galilee? Now you ought to have then a following of the accounts of the appearance in Galilee." But it ends, "For they were afraid." And in later manuscripts, you have an account of the resurrection appearances in Jerusalem. Now there was a conflict in the early church between the Jerusalem tradition and the Galilean tradition as to where the resurrection appearances at least first occurred. In John's Gospel, you got them both. In Mark's, apparently, you had the Galilean appearances cut out and the Jerusalem appearances replacing it. So it's quite possible that a piece could be cut out of the Gospel. Well, now, the cutting of it out means, if this fragment about magic is genuine, what it means is that the early church had enough sense not to be a magic cult and cut it out. But perhaps somebody in the early church interpreted it that way, and the body of the church rejected that. But then, of course, the next question is, what was magic? Faith healing, as such, wasn't magic. And Jesus said, if I, by this Beelzebub, cast out demons, how do your sons do it? He doesn't deny that they could do it. Apparently, there were others who could effect cures of mental diseases. So that wasn't magic. And as for saying the Christians were persecuted as magicians, it makes, in all of the accounts of the early persecutions, the big offense is that they don't worship Caesar as God, and that they deny the pagan gods. They're called atheists because they deny the pagan gods. It's atheism and denial of emperor worship. These are the points. So I think historically, one can't make too much of this little fragment, even if it may have been originally in the Gospel of Mark. And I haven't read the fragment yet. The book is just out, I think, with the Harvard Press. And so I wanted, naturally, to have a look at it. Well, here is a case not to prove that Jesus wasn't historical, but that he wasn't the kind of Jesus we think he is, that he was just a magician. But that goes contrary to other elements in the Gospels themselves, because Jesus not only wasn't a magician, he wasn't primarily interested in miracles as proofs. They come asking a sign. He says, no sign shall be given to you but the sign of Jonah. Now, in Luke it says, for as Jonah was a sign to the people of Nineveh, even so is the Son of Man to this generation. The sign of Jonah is the preaching of Jonah. But in Matthew, as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth, so shall the Son of Man be 3 nights in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 nights, 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. It's made the resurrection is taken as a sign, precisely the thing that Jesus said he wouldn't give them. It would only be the preaching of Jonah. Frequently, various acts of healing are called signs and proofs, but Jesus wanted the proof to lie in the spirit rather than any physical manifestation. So it's quite possible that there may be a fragment of Mark which was suppressed, and rightly suppressed, which treated him as if he were a magician. But there's a vast amount in the Gospels which shows he not only didn't want to be a magician, he didn't want to be regarded as having a divine commission because he could cure somebody. Yes?
Oh, I'd like to get back to Abraham again. I agree with you that I don't have to have God talking to him.
No.
But I see God's hand in all of this training period of Abraham. And Abraham wasn't the man that he became just by accident. The God's leading was important all along there, and the testing that came at this point. It's very intriguing to me, for example, that there was no argument with God at this point. And yet, over Sodom and Gomorrah, he would, you know, argue all the way down to 10 verses.
Yeah, he just sounded like a Palestinian merchant. That's right. No, you're right. But then he was pleading for somebody else. He could argue with God when it came to somebody else. If a command was laid on him, it was for him to do it. Oh, you're perfectly right about the character of Abraham. And with regard to God in our lives, even if it doesn't come by a specific voice. And here let me refer to Saint Teresa again, who was a powerful person in her generation. I remarked the other night that she was always having conversations with Christ. She wondered herself whether they were illusions, because the devil could disguise himself as Christ. She asked her confessor about it. He said, well, every time when Christ comes, test him out this time, make the sign of the cross. Well, she thought she'd been making it all the time, so she took in a whole crucifix. And when Christ appeared the next time, she said, oh, I'm just so sorry to show this mark of distrust. And he said, oh, it's all right, sister, God, you did it out of obedience. Well, that's a detail. The point is that Christ always appears in a crisis and tells her what to do. Now, a psychiatrist might say that she puts into his mouth what she wants to do. But the interesting thing about it is that he always tells her to do what she doesn't want to do. In her subconscious, you've got a conflict between desire and conscience. And Christ is always conscience. She wants to stay in the little monastery where she is, and she's invited to go to another one. He says, go. There's no argument. She goes. This is the faith of Abraham. You're right.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be some implication that through testing the process, that God somehow makes of Abraham someone more than what he really was. That there seems to be some underlying tone of that, you know, that through this God made of him more than what he really potentially was in and of himself. How do you see that, and how would Luther see that in terms of the freedom of the Christian man, and maybe also God's freedom as it relates to the freedom of the Christian man?
It's a very sound observation that God can make of us more than we are. Very, very true. That gets me back to Saint Teresa, by the way. She accepted the view of the inferiority of women and used it to exalt God. She said, being a mere woman is enough to take the wind out of your sails without being a wicked woman. But just see what God has done with me. So she's like a Gideon's handful, cut it down to the minimum to make God greater. So she plays on her weakness to show that God has made her somebody that she isn't. And Luther felt very much about it with regard to himself. He says, I'm the prophet of the German nation. I am. I've done something. But in God's eyes, I'm a worm. Yes, God has made out of him something that he wasn't. Yes, I think that's very true.
Is that a contradiction of the freedom of the Christian man, freedom to say no?
That gets you back into the problem of predestination, which is the most puzzling of all. How free are we anyhow? When you look back over your past, it all looks predestined. When you look at your future, it all looks open. You can see your life dovetailing together, and circumstances which at the time seem trivial suddenly making their impact and determining the course, and it looks as if it was all planned. Well, I'll tell you an example from my own experience. When I was in college, I went out for a cross-country run and maybe ran too far. Anyhow, I got back after dark, and I decided to have a swim. We didn't lock things up in those days. The gymnasium was open, but it was absolutely dark. I went to the swimming pool and went out to the end of the diving bench and was just about to plunge when I thought, I'd better check. I went down the ladder and the pool was empty.
Oh.
Why did I think at that moment? Often I do things without thinking. Why did it occur to me to check? Was that the hand of God? I reflect that if I hadn't checked, 5 children, 18 grandchildren, and 2 grandchildren, great-grandchildren wouldn't have been born. On what little things history can hang and what life can hang. I'm afraid we're up against riddles when it comes to knowing just how freely we act. Of course, in many respects, we're conditioned by traditions of which we're unaware. I never wore a wedding ring. I didn't quite know why until I discovered many years later that not only Luther but all the Puritans held that marriage is not a sacrament. It's a rite of the church. It's not a Christian sacrament. A Christian sacrament must have been instituted by Christ, but marriage was instituted by God in the Garden of Eden. So it wasn't a Christian sacrament. But the ring is the visible sign of the invisible grace. It assumes that it is a sacrament. To have a ring, therefore, makes you really a Roman Catholic. Well, now that I found all of that out, I think I might be willing. Now I found out how I was conditioned by tradition, maybe I'd be willing to have worn a wedding ring. But I didn't do it through the 45 years of my wedded life. And I didn't really know why. Here was a condition deeply implanted.
Did your wife
wear one? Yes, she did. She was willing to be tainted with Roman Catholicism. And all my children and grandchildren do too.
I think it's a good place to stop, because did you notice what Satan said about what the world would have missed? His wife and his children and his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren. And of course, all we thought about was the fact, goodness, we'd have missed all his books.
Yeah.